Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Public radio listeners are quite familiar with Dave Isay's StoryCorps, a project that has invited people to record important events in their life stories with a friend or a loved one. Since its launch in 2003, StoryCorps has collected over 50,000 conversations, which are then archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. And now Penguin Books has published a selection of some of those stories under the title Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. I'm very pleased to welcome Dave Isay back to our show. This is the fourth collection, isn't it?
It is.
Have 50,000 or so stories to tell. How many books will that be?
I think we're going to space them out. It'll be every couple of years. But I have to say, I don't think I've been on the show since StoryCorps started, believe it or not. We've done stuff together, but it's great to be back.
One unifying theme throughout this book seems to be people helping each other in times of need. Were they the kinds of stories that you were looking for when you created StoryCorps?
Well, you know, StoryCorps...
What did you have in mind? What do you think people are going to talk about?
The booth, it's not about really the stories that come out of the booth. I mean, the way we created this thing, the idea was almost to take documentary and turn it on its head. Because, you know, usually making a documentary, and I used to make documentaries, as you know, that's what mm-hmm. we used to talk about when I'd come on your show. And making a documentary is, you know, doing recordings with people and then synthesizing it into a film, or in my case, radio or whatever it is. And that's the product, you know, that's the benefit, that documentary touching people. And when I did these radio documentaries over the years, I came to see that the act of being interviewed, of being listened to, as you know, could be an important moment in people's lives. For some people who felt not listened to, could be transformative at times. So what I wanted to do was try this experiment and build this booth where people could be listened to. So it's really not about the stories. It's the act of being listened to. And those are the 50,000 interviews we've done. I didn't know if we'd have radio coming out of the StoryCorps booth, and it wasn't the intention.
It took two years before you wound up on NPR.
Yeah. So we put some stories on WNYC very early on. And now they keep coming. But yeah, so this was the book we put out for our 10th anniversary, which is now out in paperback. And so much of StoryCorps is about generosity and gratitude. I mean, StoryCorps is kind of the opposite of reality TV. No one comes to get rich. No one comes to get famous. It's an act of gratitude and love. So a book of stories of gratitude seemed to make sense. And that's a very good kind of match with what happens in the StoryCorps booth.
Although they are in the interview form, one big difference from what I do here is that they almost sound in many cases as a form of therapy. People are unburdening themselves or telling a story that they think it's important for others to hear, stories that were really powerful aspects of their own lives.
Yeah, I think...
A lot of confessions also.
Yeah, I think of it less as therapy and more as just an opportunity to connect with another human being. And similar to what happens in this room with you, as you know, and one of the reasons why I thought StoryCorps might work is that the microphone gives you the license to talk about things you don't normally get to talk about. So I think of it less as therapy and more, if you're going to put it in that realm, as a way to have kind of closure with another person. So there are some similarities between StoryCorps, I think, and what happens even in hospice, where, you know, you want to say certain things to someone before they die. And people who come to StoryCorps, hopefully, in most cases, aren't actively dying. But you have the opportunity to say things like, I love you, and, you know, this is what's important to me, and this is how I want to be remembered, and forgive me, and that sort of stuff.
Although a number of the people who have participated have died since.
Yes. Well, I mean,
and this is a way of their being remembered.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And that's a big part of StoryCorps as well. And sure, I mean, we've been around for 10 years. As you said, we've done 50,000 interviews. We just had our 100,000th participant, because most people come in pairs, and many, many, many people have died, including my own dad. So I did a StoryCorps interview with him many years ago and didn't give much thought to it. And then a couple of years ago, he was working. He worked 40 hours a week, like a very young looking, fit guy. And he was a psychiatrist.
He was a guest on our show to talk about a couple of his books.
Yes, yes. Fantastic guy, huge influence on my life, and got sick with cancer and was dead like 8 days later. And it was that night listening to his voice. I'm an old dad. I have two young kids. The night he died, this is the only record, that we have of his voice. And knowing that this was the way my young kids were going to get to know this man who was like the most important person in my life. Like, that's when the rubber really hits the road and you realize the importance of having this record.
Did it help you with your own grieving process?
Sure. I mean, it did. I mean, I'm a radio person, so I cut something for his funeral. It gives you want to have something purposeful to do in that sort of time period. But it was very comforting to know that I had this thing. It's interesting because when I listened to the piece, I had always teased my dad. You talk about his books. When we did the interview, one of the things that you ask someone typically in an interview is, what are you proudest of? And almost everybody who has kids says their kids. And what I remembered my dad saying was my books, and I always.
But they're also his children.
Yes, exactly. And I gave him a hard time about it for years. I was like, Dad, like, you are the only person, tens of thousands of these. And you're the and you said books. And, the night he died, I listened to that interview and I said, what are you proudest of? And he said, my kids.
Now, you had to have been scared when you started StoryCorps. Weren't you leaving a day job to do this?
I didn't. Yeah. I mean, I was still making radio documentaries at the time. It was this crazy experiment. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if we opened this booth in Grand Central Terminal and invited people to come in. So I didn't know if we'd have, reality TV, like people shooting each other in the booth. I mean, I had all kinds of fears.
And who was your first participant?
The StoryCorps interview number one was my great uncle Sandy. Now, this was before we actually opened the booth. Down in Chinatown, we set up a booth out of, baffles with styrofoam about the size of a booth. And I brought my uncle Sandy, who was a good test because I had these crazy this was my great uncle Sandy, and I had a grandmother who was a wild character who was a columnist for the New York Post for many years. And she had these sisters who were crazier than she was. Her sister Bertie, who was my Uncle Sandy's wife, insisted she'd invented fruit salad. I mean, these people were like out of their minds. Fantastic, but out of their minds. And my Uncle Sandy, who was the last living person from that generation, was just like a quiet guy. And the question is, like, what happens when you don't bring a big character in to do something like this? So I thought I'd test it on Sandy, and I brought him in, and he told me stuff he'd never talked about. He'd certainly never told me. He talked about his first date with my great Aunt Bertie, which was on 14th Street, and it was right after World War II. And he said that he had met her and asked her for this date to meet him on a stoop on 14th Street around Union Square, just a random stoop. And he said that he saw her coming down the street, and she was dressed in purple from head to toe. And he said she was the most glamorous, beautiful thing he'd ever seen. And he turned and tried to escape. He said, what's she going to see, this beauty going to see in a farm boy like me? And he tried to escape, and the door was locked. And he started crying, and he said, I often think if that door wasn't locked, it would have destroyed my life. I wouldn't have gotten to be with her. And he ended up driving around. He's passed away now. He was 88 or 89 at the time. And he still drove, and he would drive around and listen to that CD over and over again, which was a good sign that this thing was going to work.
My guest is Dave Isay, who has just released another book called, this one, Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. A lot of these stories are about redemption. There's the story of Susan McClinton and her husband Philip McClinton, who used drugs, and neither of them completed school beyond ninth grade. And there's a combination of unburdening, but also a pride in how they came from terrible things early in their lives to becoming successes.
Yeah, they actually they met at a strip club. He was a bouncer at the strip club, and she came in to try to make some extra money by stripping for her. She was a single mom at the time, and they fell in love, and then they both realized that they loved biology and put each other through college and ended up with PhDs.
Despite the fact that they had only gone to the ninth grade?
That's right.
But college was difficult for them because they hadn't really developed some of the academic skills that are necessary.
That's right. And they had all kinds of tricks that they'd use. Yeah.
One man who grew up in a difficult situation was Cole Williams, who talked to his godfather, Ralph Catania, the man who helped him raise his son after he became a teenage father.
Yeah.
A lot of these people had terrible lives that they had to overcome. A big theme in the book seems to be of finding family out of unusual circumstances. Stephen Lynch, for example, talks about being raised by his gay father and his father's friends who were also gay.
Yeah. I mean, this was I've had the chance. One of the great – I mean, we've done so many interviews, and I spend my time running StoryCorps now, and I don't really get to meet people who participate. But when I do a book or sometimes with radio stories and I do events, I get to meet folks. And I've met Stefan several times, and, you know, it's a remarkable story. You know, we were talking about my dad. I'm the son of a gay man, and he was as well. He was brought up by his father and his aunties, as he called them, and tells the story of his dad and all of his aunties one by one dying of AIDS in the 1980s.
So this is also, to some degree, a history
sure.
of our times.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you know, Studs Terkel, who cut the ribbon on our first booth when we opened all those many years ago, who has also passed away, talked about, you know, always talked about the importance of bottom-up history. And I think that through the voices of these regular people, while they're not directly on it, they're not being asked about historical events, give such a rich kind of the tapestry of those historic events and the feelings behind those events come out in ways that are completely unique.
There are an awful lot of stories in this book about illness and loss. Is that something that people feel compelled to talk about? Or is it just the book stories that you've collected here?
No, I think, you know, look, StoryCorps is a place where people come in and talk about important things. What happens in a StoryCorps booth, the kind of stories that we hear about the great themes of human existence. I mean, that's the nature of what's happening in the booth. So there are stories about death and birth and illness. And, you know, it's a lot about talking about what has been most difficult and what has been most joyful in your life. And what I hope StoryCorps does is gives us, when we're in the booth, a chance to kind of reflect on what's really important. And when we listen to these stories or read these stories in a book that, you know, you get a little shake on the shoulder and are kind of reminded, like, this is what's important.
One of the most compelling stories involves Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel, who developed a deep bond after Israel shot Ms. Johnson's son to death when he was a teenager. How can you develop a relationship after that?
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. It's beautiful in print and in radio also. And, you know, I think what StoryCorps tells is a real American story that we don't usually hear. And, you know, this is a story about a mom whose son only kid was murdered. She went in and to prison after 12 years of this kid serving a sentence for her son's murder to find out who this person was, and went back over and over again, and they developed a friendship. And when he moved out of when he was released from prison after 15 or 16 years, he moved in next door to her. And this was recorded a few months after he had been released. And they came to the StoryCorps booth to talk about this friendship and how it developed over the years. And it's interesting also because you can see it's a little bit of there's kind of some meta stuff about what happens in StoryCorps where the mom thanks O'Shea for having the courage to come in and sit and look her in the eyes and talk about these difficult things. And then at the end of the interview, as you'll see in the book, you know, she calls him son.
How important do you think it is that these things are done in a booth, different than a studio of the sort that we're talking in? Do you think that the booth leads people to be more open and honest?
You know, I had a couple theories when StoryCorps started. One was that you needed, when a StoryCorps interview happens, there's a trained facilitator there who helps you through the process. They talk about, they call it bearing witness to these interviews. And that's turned out to be extremely important.
They stay in the booth?
They're in the booth through the whole thing. They keep logs of what happens. They're trained by StoryCorps. It's an exhausting job because you witness so much difficult stuff. People serve for a year, 2 years, sometimes 3 years. I also thought you needed the sacred space, you know, which is not that different than this studio. Where, you know, it's a soundproof booth and it's completely quiet. The lights are low. But that turned out to be wrong. We can set up microphones anywhere in any quiet room, and people have essentially the same experience, which kind of freed us up from having to stick to the booths and allow us to travel across the country. So the facilitators will put equipment on their back and set up in a conference room or a community center or a library, and people have the exact same experience.
Do most of the people come in prepared to talk about one thing?
They come in prepared.
But do they wind up talking about something else in many cases?
They do. You know, what happens is people, you know, I come from a journalistic background, and you well know that preparation is so important. So we tell people they need to prepare before they come. So people go through a question generator where we have kind of the top 10 StoryCorps questions and then hundreds of others you can choose. And you bring those with you. Sometimes you've discussed it with the person you're interviewing. Most times you haven't. And you can add your own questions. The facilitators will always tell the people coming into the booth, the interviewer, to ask that question they always wanted to ask, because the 40 minutes goes by so fast. So people will stick to the script or not stick to the script. But the important thing is just listening.
And the facilitators sometimes have to be witness to some pretty emotional stuff.
Every day. Yeah, every day.
And helping people get through them.
Well, you know, I think that they're, you know, they're not trained as psychologists or therapists, you know, but they have a lot of training. And, you know, it's a tribute to the facilitators that we've done 55,000 of these interviews. I mean, I think probably people have cried in every one of those interviews. Some of them have been extraordinarily difficult. I mean, as you know, we have every 9/11 family comes to StoryCorps, mm-hmm. working with post 9/11 vets now and their families. But, you know, every single one of those 55,000 interviews has gone well. And that's a tribute to the great skill of the facilitators and the people who train them.
Do you think that you became interested in doing something like this because your father was a psychiatrist?
I think
because people go to psychiatrists to talk about these kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, I my family were all therapists, except on my mom.
Was
my
that
mom
discussed
is
over the dinner table?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think if you were going to really kind of psychoanalyze things, you know, you might say that the fact that my dad was gay and I didn't know it had as much of an impact as the fact that he was a therapist. Because, again, the StoryCorps booth gives you the chance to talk about things in a comfortable space. Secrets at times. Yeah.
You were recently awarded the 2015 TED Prize in order to fulfill your vision for StoryCorps. What did you get, and what did you say your vision was?
So it's a thrill. It's $1 million prize, and
you got a couple of bucks for me
after. Yeah, I'm buying lunch, but it's to be put to use for StoryCorps. I actually it's to fulfill a wish, which I am not allowed to talk about until I give a TED talk in March where I announce the wish. So more to come on that.
Dave Isay is the founder of StoryCorps and the recipient of numerous broadcasting honors, including 6 Peabody Awards. That's a lot.
Well, you know,
I was happy to get one.
I was very lucky as a young person to fall into radio. I found my calling and was able to get funding early on so that I could spend a long time doing stories that really mattered to me.
Also, doing television things for POV.
Well, we animate some of the StoryCorps stories. So everything now, when you asked about, you know, kind of leaving my career, about a year into StoryCorps, I understood the potential of this thing. And, you know, this is about connection and ultimately about culture change, hopefully, and making us a culture that listens better to one another and, you know, recognizes the core idea of StoryCorps is that, you know, that every life matters equally. So when I when I realized that the potential of StoryCorps, I retired from doing radio documentaries to devote my life to hopefully building this into a sustaining institution that will someday kind of move the needle in this country.
And the latest print version is Ties That Bind: Stories of Loves and Gratitude from the first 10 years of StoryCorps, published by Penguin. Dave Isay, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks, Lenny. Happy holidays.
Stephen Johnson's latest book, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World, contains a few surprises. Not thematically. Innovation, synergy, and change have always interested Mr. Johnson, but some of his selections may seem a bit puzzling and unspectacular at first. And yet, in his hands, even basic materials like glass and an innovator like Clarence Birdseye, whose driving force in life was to provide us with a decent-tasting frozen pea, became the pillars of civilization. Stephen Johnson and I spoke last September, and we are rebroadcasting that conversation for you now. I began by asking Mr. Johnson about a book that made a big impact on him. It was written two decades ago by a historian and filmmaker named Manuel de Landa.
Yeah, that's right. I read this amazing book called War in the Age of Intelligent Machines when I was in grad school, actually, here in New York at Columbia. And he had this conceit at the beginning of the book that has stuck with me, 20 years later, which he imagined what he called a robot historian. He imagined, 100 years, let's say there's this, robot that's self-aware and capable of writing history. What would the robot's history of the last 1,000 years look like, right? It would involve human beings, but it would also, the technology that led up to a robot being smart enough to write history would be very different, and you would kind of look at the last 1,000 years through a different lens. And so what I tried to do in this book and in that we have a TV series on PBS that accompanies it is to look at the history of the last 1,000 years from the technology's perspective first, from the ideas and scientific breakthroughs perspective, and to show how those things changed people rather than people changing the technology.
So you picked six innovations, and then those things all spread out to a lot more.
Yeah, the idea was to really have six objects that are part of the modern world, but we don't even think of really as technology anymore. So six very basic things like a glass of clean drinking water or a clock or air conditioning and to show how behind these seemingly ordinary objects there's this amazing history.
Now, you start off with glass, but how did you decide to start off there? You could have started with fire or the wheel, and glass wouldn't have been possible without fire.
Yeah, what we wanted to do is really have these objects that aren't the traditional ones you think of, and to have the stories in the book be as fresh as possible. So part of it was, let's surprise people a bit and say, well, listen, here's some things that you don't even think of glass as technology anymore. Whereas 1,000 years ago, actually, the glassmakers in Venice were some of the most advanced technologists in a sense of the day, and we assume, that fire is the original innovation, that being able to heat things up and cook things is important to society. But I think if you could take glass out of the last 1,000 years somehow, if you could rewrite the rules of physics so that silicon dioxide doesn't transmit light the way that it does, the entire course of human history over that period would have been changed.
Well, when you say how we got to now, what are you talking about? You just said human history, but aren't you really talking about Eurocentric history?
Yeah, this book is centered on Europeans and Americans, and I talk about this a little bit in the introduction. The kind of we of how we got to now would be very different if you wrote it from an Asian perspective, for instance.
Because glass comes to China at a later date, but I don't know whether it comes through.
Yeah, and it gets in, and we talk about mirrors, for instance. Mirrors are a part of Japanese and Chinese culture at different points and have different influences. But what is interesting, though, is that there's certain experiences like the Enlightenment and industrialization that, for very complicated historical reasons, happened first in the West. And so when you're thinking about innovation, it's a good place to start.
Well, you say something happened 26 million years ago in the Libyan desert that created glass. First of all, how do we know that?
Well, there's this part of the Libyan desert that's filled with these very ancient kind of fragments of glass, and they've been able to date it back to 26 million years ago. But it was unclear what it was. So basically, it was hot enough to fuse the entire surface of the desert into glass, which requires temperatures in excess of like 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So what's interesting is like one fragment of this glass, someone encountered it many, many years ago, and it wound its way through human society, got kind of polished, and ended up as part of King Tut's tomb.
Which is pretty far away from the Libyan desert.
Yeah, yeah. So you could see early on there was this fascination with naturally forming glass. When humans encountered it, they would say, well, there's something very interesting there.
And then you talk about the history of glass fitting into the fall of Constantinople.
Well, there was a lot of expertise in Constantinople. The kind of state-of-the-art in glassmaking technology resided in Constantinople. And after the fall...
Do we know why there? Because there were so many other places that were hubs of activity.
Yeah, but you had the kind of Islamic Renaissance during that period. And so you had a lot of expertise about optics, too, that came out of that culture. And so and kind of glass was central to that as well. So... whatever reason, this cluster develops there. And then after the fall, they end up going to Venice. And then this extraordinary thing happens in Venice where these glassmakers show up in Venice. And they've got this amazing technology. But Venice is largely a city made entirely of wooden buildings at that point. And, you know, to make glass, you need these furnaces that are heated up to 1,000 degrees or more. And so the glassmakers brought this great commerce and new technology to Venice, but they kept kind of burning down the city. And so the kind of Venetian elders eventually said, we want you around, but we don't want you right next door to us. So they sent them over to this other island of Murano, which you can, you know, visit today and see these glassmakers. And it created this hub of innovation. They were kind of condensed into this small area, and they were forced to stay there. And it was threatened with the death penalty if they left. And through that kind of close-knit community, they end up inventing some of the clearest glass that's ever been made and set off a revolution in glassmaking.
Well, I think of Murano glass as being decorative. When did glass go from being something that you use for decoration to something that you could use instead of ceramics, let's say, or to use for windows? Earlier, they had used thin layers of minerals for window quartz, I think it was.
Yeah.
When did glass start?
Well, I think the big turning point actually in the history of the kind of modern use of glass comes just after this period. And it comes about – this is one of my favorite stories in the book. It comes about because of Gutenberg in this roundabout way. So people – monks basically had first developed glass lenses to use as spectacles in around 1100, 1200. But this was a very rare technology. It was not part of mainstream society at all. And then Gutenberg invents the printing press. And all of a sudden, Europe is awash with these books. And people start to read for the first time. And a significant number of those people, in reading for the first time, say, geez, I'm farsighted. I can't read these tiny letters on this page, which was a problem that was – you know, it was there in the human population. It just no one noticed it because they really didn't have occasion to look at very small things next to their eyes. And so all of a sudden there's this surge in demand for spectacles. Spectacles become a kind of semi-mainstream technology, which means that all of Europe is suddenly filled with experts in lens making. And those lens makers, through their kind of natural curiosity, begin to experiment with putting lenses side by side and things like that. And through that, they invent the telescope and the microscope, which almost instantly – you know, revolutionizes astronomy, our understanding of our place in the universe, and biology, understanding of the cell and eventually viruses and bacteria.
And it continues into the 19th, 20th centuries. A physicist that H.G. Wells called one of the worst teachers who has ever turned his back on a restive audience was responsible for another innovation involving glass.
Yeah, we actually recreated this in the PBS series, which is really fun. It's this guy, Charles Boys, and he was actually looking for materials to create a very delicate kind of balance arm for a scale. There's a sub-theme in this book about the importance of measuring, that every time we develop new tools to measure and new levels of accuracy in measurement, we see new transformations in society. And Boyes came up with this idea that he could take a kind of a molten piece of semi-liquid glass, heat it up, and fire it with a crossbow. And which, you know, most of us is not something we do for fun.
Not something that would have occurred to me.
Yeah. So we did this in the show. We got a crossbow. We heated up this glass and fired across. And what it creates is this very thin and remarkably stable and strong fiber. And that fiber became the basis for fiberglass. And eventually it became the basis for fiber optics. And now this is this funny thing we never think about. But the internet and the web are on some fundamental level, they're made of glass. They're made out of these fiber optics. All this information that we share is being transmitted through little threads of glass.
And we have Google Glass.
So yeah, it just keeps going.
But goes around. But mirrors, you mentioned mirrors. Who invented mirrors?
Well, there's not a kind of a – as with many of these technologies, there's not a kind of a single inventor of the mirror. But kind of fine polished mirrors that gave you an accurate – representation of your face first start to appear right at the early days of the Renaissance in Europe.
As a substitute for polished metals.
Yeah, you could have these – they would have these polished metals and they just were kind of blurry and you didn't – so you had this interesting phenomenon which we don't think about a lot, which is that most human beings on the planet spent – most of their life without ever seeing a very clear image of their own face, which is a funny thing to think about. Anyway, at the beginning of the Renaissance, mirrors start to circulate more, and they become central to both the art and the kind of philosophy of the Renaissance because, one, perspective in painting is partially invented using mirrors, and then you see this explosion in self-portraits. And self-portraits just weren't really part of the artistic kind of palette. Until the Renaissance, until these mirrors came along.
And then a lot of mirrors in Renaissance paintings.
Yeah, yeah. It's
all over, not just Italy, but in fact one of the most famous Flemish paintings has a mirror in the back of – what is it? Not concave, convex mirror.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, they're just these – and if you go to any art gallery that has art from that period, you see mirrors everywhere. So it was one of these things where it was very advanced technology for the day. And the interesting argument is that we think –
that leads to using makeup.
It leads to the selfie, you know, 600 years later. But it also leads to a different kind of understanding of selfhood in a way and a kind of an introspective mode in society that was not common before the introduction of mirrors.
My guest is Stephen Johnson, whose latest book is How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. You write about refrigeration, which actually just begins with the need for gas, for ice.
Yeah. There's this amazing figure named Frederick Tudor, who at the beginning of the 19th century is this kind of well-to-do Bostonian, and he has this idea that he can take large chunks of ice from a frozen lake in New England and ship it all around the world to these hot climates and thus make a fortune. And for 10 years, he kind of pursues this vision. It's a total disaster for a lot of reasons. But the biggest one is that even once he manages to get the ice to the Caribbean, for instance, when it shows up, nobody knows what to do with it. Everybody's like, what would we do with ice? We don't have any need for ice. I just hadn't seen any ice. I'd never experienced things
like
that.
So he goes bankrupt.
But eventually he figures out a system and persuades people, and he makes a huge fortune.
We are going to put this on ice for just a moment while we take a little break, and we'll come back with more about refrigeration, and we'll get to bird's eye and whatever else we can talk about. My guest is Stephen Johnson, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. It is published by Riverhead Books. We're back with a rebroadcast of a conversation I had in September with New York Times bestselling science writer Stephen Johnson. His latest book is called how we got to now, six innovations that made the modern world. Let's get back to refrigeration for a moment.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we have Tudor going bankrupt and then eventually figuring it out and becoming rich.
Yeah, and in a funny way, we still experience the kind of long distant echo of Tudor's innovation, because Americans to this day are much more likely to put ice in their drinks, right? You go to Europe and everybody's like, what are you doing with all that ice in your soda or your coffee? And it's really the legacy of this one guy who became this huge evangelist for ice and ice-cooled
beverages. So he gave us the ice cube.
Yeah, really did. But he did it all in an old-fashioned way of chopping up chunks of ice from a lake and shipping them around the world.
And so that was the ice box.
That was, yeah. People, in fact, I actually, in my new house in Brooklyn, we have an old-style ice box that's left over from, 1880. And it was – and. The ice trade, cities like New York became hugely dependent on these big blocks of ice being distributed through the whole city. And when you would have ice famines, when you'd have an unusually warm winter, and there'd be these, really anguished articles in the New York Times saying, like, there's not going to be enough ice this winter. The city's going to, fall to pieces.
Well, it also was responsible for keeping meat fresh, for example. Refrigeration had a major impact on the economics of cattle breeding in the Great Plains. But then somebody figures out how to manufacture it, not to just chop it out of frozen lakes.
Right. Once it's an interesting thing where, like, once Tudor and his peers proved that there was a market for cold, and cold became kind of dependent in the growing kind of national food network. I mean, ice was central to Chicago. Chicago couldn't have become the kind of meatpacking hub that it was without ice powered, ice cooled refrigerated cars. Which were just refrigerated with big blocks of ice. They actually didn't have the technology of refrigeration at that point. But then people started saying, okay, we can invent artificial cold and kind of manufacture it. We don't have to extract it from a lake. And that set off kind of the next phase of the story of cold.
So we have refrigeration. We have air conditioners, which are originally designed, I think, to protect paper in printing plants in the summertime.
It's a great New York story, actually. Out kind of near Williamsburg, there was a printing shop that did kind of high quality color magazine printing, and this is like the early 1900s. And in the summer, it would get so humid in the printing shop that the ink would kind of run on the page, and it was a big problem. And so they hired a young engineer whose name was Willis Carrier, eventually of the Carrier Air Conditioning Company, and to solve this problem, basically just to dehumidify the air. And so he built this contraption that dehumidified the air in the printing room, but it also made it nice and cool. And all of a sudden, all the employees there were like, I'm going to have my lunch in the printing room. That was really nice. And so he forms this company. And one of the first places that ordinary people experience air conditioning is in movie theaters in the kind of mid-20s. And the funny thing about this is, up until the invention of air conditioning, the last place you would want to go in the summer was a movie theater. I mean, it's hot outside. It's hot in this space. There's 1,000 people crowded into a room with body temperatures 98.6. So air conditioning first becomes integrated into kind of everyday life through movies, and it creates the possibility of a summer blockbuster, right? There's never had a summer blockbuster without air conditioning. But the big change comes when AC becomes part of people's homes, which starts around 1950. And that triggers really the largest migration of American people in the history of the country, when all these people moved to the Sun Belt and to Florida and to Vegas and to places that were really hard to live before air conditioning in the home. And that ends up changing the political balance in the country. You have all these retirees move to the South, and there's a massive swing of 50 or 60 votes in the Electoral College from North to South. And, it's very hard to imagine Ronald Reagan getting elected president without that kind of Sunbelt coalition of states that he kind of rode into office on. So here you have this is the way technology changes the world, right? You start with somebody trying to keep the ink from smearing on the page in Brooklyn, and 80 years later, you're helping Ronald Reagan get elected president.
We have – it also allowed Clarence Birdseye to come up with the idea of flash freezing. And now even the smallest supermarket has a number of frozen food cases in it. He was just simply trying to come up with a better pea? Canned peas weren't good enough for him?
Well, I love – Birdseye is one of my favorite characters in this because he has this property that a lot of these people do, which is he was just intensely curious about things. And one of the kind of important experiences that he has is he goes off to work kind of as a naturalist in Labrador. And he's there with his young family, and it's in the middle of the winter in Labrador, and there's very little fresh food around. And he goes ice fishing with these local Inuits, and he's out on a lake. We actually recreated this in the PBS series, so I actually did this ice fishing myself. And it's so cold that when they catch a fish and they bring it out, it freezes almost instantly just by kind of pulling it out of the water. It's frozen in a matter of seconds. And when he goes and then thaws out this fish a couple of days later and cooks it and eats it with his family, he's like, that was so much better tasting than normal frozen food. What was that? Now, most of us at that point would just say, I had a good meal. That was good. I don't know why, but he was like, why did it taste so good? And so he set off and did all these crazy kind of mad scientist experiments by freezing different foods at different speeds and different temperatures. And eventually he realized that if you freeze something very quickly at a very low temperature, it will have less kind of cellular decomposition.
Now, we can't get to all of the things that you write about here, recording sound, what the Bell Labs did, even though it's wonderful. But I do want to just touch a bit on Ellis Chesbrough and the fact that he actually raised Chicago to develop a sewer system. Raised whole buildings in some cases with people in them?
Yeah. Chicago's problem, I was just there last week and I was walking around on the streets that he did this on. Chicago is insanely flat. And so there's no natural kind of grade to drain any waste, any sewer lines into the city, into the river or into the lake as they used to do. And so his idea was if we could just artificially elevate the entire downtown area, this is in the middle of the 19th century, we can create a natural kind of flow. And so he set out and did this. Thousands of people kind of armed with these jack screws. They would lift up these buildings. They filled. They created 10 feet of landfill that the roads went on. And they would sometimes move the buildings to kind of make way for the new sewer systems. And so you would see these huge hotels populated by people still staying in them, moving around. It was just extraordinary.
Another story you tell, and I'm not surprised that Galileo plays a role in it, helps us keep accurate time.
The story of time, I mean, every step of the way in the history of time, whenever we have a kind of order of magnitude increase in our ability to measure time, amazing new things happen. And Galileo, the kind of legendary story, and there's some dispute about whether this really happened.
You mean he didn't do the pendulum?
He did. He did the pendulum clock. But the question is whether he was inspired as a kid. And there's a lot of evidence that he was, but there's some people who don't believe this. But that he was at the cathedral in Pisa and was seeing this pendulum swaying back and forth. And as everybody else is like reciting the Lord's Prayer or something, he's like, yeah, the physical behavior of that pendulum is very interesting to me. And it planted this seed in his mind, which actually took 50 years to kind of crystallize into the pendulum clock itself.
But it changes the whole way that we think about time because we then want it to be accurate instead of kind of, well, it's around noon or so. How we got to now, six innovations that made the modern world. Stephen, thank you so much for being on our show again. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
It's always great to be on it. Love the conversation.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There's an estimate 50,000 Chinese restaurants in the United States, and almost all of them have a sweet, slightly spicy deep-fried chicken dish called General Tso's Chicken on their menus. But who was General Tso, and was the dish created for him? Well, the hunt for the mystery man of Chinese-American cuisine led director Ian Chaney and producer Jennifer Lee to travel across the globe for their new film called The Search for General Tso. The film opens tonight at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village, and I'm very pleased to welcome Jennifer Lee and Ian Chaney to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Or ni hao. Ian, wasn't Tso Chung-Tang a 19th century Chinese general and statesman?
He sure was.
So how did he come to have a dish named after him?
Well, that's a story that certainly unfolds in the course of our documentary.
We don't want to give away any secrets.
We don't want to give away all the secrets.
No real secrets here, are there?
No, there aren't. It's all somewhat Googleable. And actually, the idea for this film came about before we had smartphones, so maybe it would have ended immediately. But yeah, he was I kind of think of him as like the General Sherman of China, quelled a rebellion led by a guy claiming to be the brother of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And while it's likely that he ate some chicken in his life, and there were images of chickens on his bed that we found in China, we never really got to the bottom of whether he himself would have loved a dish as syrupy and sweet as General So's chicken.
Well, Hunan, Jennifer, where he came from, is more famous for its spicy food, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting because General Tso's chicken, while he is from Hunan province, is definitely not the kind of dish that you would find in Hunan province. And so when we went and showed pictures of General Tso's chicken and it's all in all its like red syrupy goodness to the locals, some of whom were descended from General Tso himself, they were very, very baffled by this dish, oftentimes asking, is this Chinese food? Because it doesn't actually look like Chinese food to them, because, you know, as Chinese food has evolved around the world, especially in America, it becomes, you know, sweeter and fatter because these are things that Americans like.
Although, again, I'm not going to give away all the details, it does have its origins in China, the dish, but a very different kind of dish from what the American variations have created.
Absolutely. When General Tso's chicken finally found its way to the United States, it began to change. And actually, those first changes happened right here in New York City about 40 years ago.
And so we're to blame.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that New York deserve to blame for, I think, including the chicken.
I've read a number of different theories as to who actually invented General Tso's chicken. Do you think you've come up with the definitive answer?
I think, well, what we're lucky, what's actually really good now is that most of the people involved in General Tso's chicken, except for General Tso himself, are still mostly alive. And so we can kind of reconstruct like a he said, she said, and there are lots of different, there's slight variations of, you know, the origin of the chicken and the man, but we think we've come up with a pretty good hypothesis of how the chicken came to be and why we're all eating it across the country.
If somebody cooked the typical American General Tso's chicken in China, do you think Chinese people, let's say in Hong Kong, which is a great culinary center, or Beijing, do you think that this would be a popular dish?
We wandered the streets of Shanghai showing people images of American General Tso's chicken and as happened in General Tso's hometown in Hunan province, got a number of bewildered looks. One young woman thought it actually looked like a frog. But apparently, I haven't been there yet, but in Shanghai there is a new restaurant. I think it's called Fortune Cookie.
It's an American-Chinese restaurant.
Which, yeah. Of course, fortune cookies are an American invention as well.
Exactly. So I guess there were so many expats longing for their old American-Chinese food that somebody decided to capitalize on it.
It's interesting how many variations on how American restaurants spell or pronounce General Tso's chicken. I looked it up, and there's Governor Tso's chicken, General Gao's chicken, General Tao's chicken, General Tso's chicken, General Tong's chicken, General Tang's chicken, General Cho's chicken, General Chow's chicken, General Joe's chicken, TSO chicken, General Ching's chicken, House chicken, or simply General's chicken.
Yes. My favorite is actually at the U.S. Naval Academy, where it's called Admiral Tso's chicken.
So Admiral Town?
Admiral Tso's chicken. He's gone nautical. No generals there.
So is the dish prepared pretty much the same way, depending, no matter what the name is, or do we see variations around the country?
You can certainly find some things in common. If you drive across the country, there's a Chinese restaurant in almost every town across America, which is one of the things that made us so curious in the first place. And you will find some things in common. You know, it's usually fried in America, it tends to be fairly bready, and it's generally pretty sweet, and you know, the spice will probably vary from city to city. So I think in areas of the country where folks might have favor a spicier cuisine, you might find people varying their General Tso's chicken to adapt to that local taste.
Yeah,
how did you get to? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, but in general, the traits that you'll see are it is sweet, it is fried, and it is chicken, which are all things that Americans love, which is one of the reasons we think he's had such a long march across the country.
How does it compare in popularity with other Americanized ethnic dishes like pizza or bagels? Has it replaced chow mein, chop suey, and egg foo young as the most ubiquitous Chinese-American dish?
Yeah, I think I would argue that General Tso's chicken is the dominant sort of signature Chinese-American dish, and probably the words that are spoken most by Americans across the country as they're ordering at their takeouts and restaurants. And one thing that's interesting is a friend of ours that's interviewed in the movie, Ed Schoenfeld, estimates that it's at least a $1 billion business in and of itself, that one dish. And like when we did the math out, that actually seems pretty reasonable that annually there's $1 billion worth of General Tso's chicken that is like spread across the country.
Well, chow mein, chop suey, and egg foo young have disappeared because people think of them as inauthentic, which they are. But do they think of General Tso's chicken as General Tso's or whatever we're going to call it, as being more authentic?
I wonder whether the name has something to do with it. I think this mysterious sounding and to many Americans vaguely unpronounceable name has contributed to a sense that surely this comes from far afield, or surely this is some old recipe handed down. And as we talked to people in the course of making the film, everybody had their own pet theory of who General Tso was and how the chicken dish came to be. And it was one of the delights of making
the film.
Definitely
gives it a kind of mystique. And what I really actually love is the sort of brand extensions that General Tso has sort of experienced, much of which is in New York City. So there's General Tso's dumplings, General Tso's pizza in California, in Canada. There's General Tso's potato chips, which I thought was really interesting. And then General Tso's seitan. It's like kind of it's really interesting how like the man has become a brand in and of himself.
And then we have Chicken McNuggets, which kind of are a variant with the sauce that McDonald's offers. My guests are Jennifer Lee and Ian Cheney. We're talking about their film called The Search for General Tso, which opens tonight at the IFC Center on Avenue of the Americas in Greenwich Village. Do Chinese restaurants in Europe, Latin America, or Africa serve General Tso's chicken? Is this totally U.S.?
So one place that is interesting is Chinese restaurants abroad which serve American Chinese food. So in Korea, for example, there is a chain of Chinese restaurants that serves Americanized Chinese food do often have dishes like General Tso's chicken or beef with broccoli. So as a sort of signature of America, General Tso has sort of become to symbolize that. Okay.
Is it ironic that General Tso believed in preserving Chinese culture?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of his hallmarks, really, was being deeply proud of Chinese culture and really defending the homeland and being very skeptical of foreigners. So, the dish was likely named after him to celebrate his love of China. So then to have this dish turn around and conquer America is remarkable. One of the things we noticed immediately in China, even though we didn't see a lot of General Tso's chicken, we saw a lot of Kentucky Fried Chicken. So while the general was conquering America, the colonel in his way was conquering China.
Yeah.
The original General Tso's chicken was not sweet.
No,
in fact. It's a more Chinese-type dish.
So I don't want to give anything away, but we do actually spend a lot of time kind of getting to the original version of General Tso's chicken. And it is not sweet, it is not fried, and there's no broccoli. That's actually one of the more kind of surprising things. So broccoli is not a Chinese vegetable. It's actually an Italian vegetable that came to the States and then became very popular in America in the 1920s.
Well, they could have put bok choy there or something.
Yeah,
like
but it's not. So it's like when you see the General Tso's chicken in its original kind of glorious state of being, it is definitely not what you would meet. And there's a lot of bones. That's the bones and skin. And that's really weird from a American standpoint, because we don't like to be reminded that our food ever was alive or walked or swam or flew or something. So it's always very, our General Tso's chicken is very sanitized from like being, whereas like the original version actually still kind of embraces the fact it came from a chicken.
When you spoke to Chinese chefs, people who'd come here from China and are now cooking this, what was their take on this? This is just what you got to do to pay the bills?
Largely. I mean, what we found so amazing as we traveled across the country was the ways in which chefs have innovated and adapted. And it's fairly decentralized. I mean, many get their menus, et cetera, printed in Chinatowns, but they're often adapting to local flavors. So in Springfield, Missouri, we met with a family who had invented something called Springfield cashew chicken, which, you know, more or less looks like fried chicken with brown gravy, which, of course, is a beloved Midwestern food. So, you know, as you travel across the country, you can find chefs who are taking some of these general themes, but also placing a little twist on them. And I think there's a certain pride in making your General Tso's chicken a little bit unique to your restaurant.
Isn't there Sichuan alligator in New Orleans?
Yes. I love Cajun Chinese food. So one of the most amazing things about Chinese food in general around the world is how it adapts to local palate. So there's like Peruvian Chinese food and Korean Chinese food. And even within the United States, you have, you know, Cajun Chinese food. So you have like Sichuan Chinese food, mm-hmm. right? So you have Sichuan alligator and sweet and sour crawfish. Those are our favorites, kind of down in Louisiana.
Your film also covers the history of Chinese immigration in the United States, including the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. Why was that enacted?
Well, it's interesting because that piece of legislation is actually the first time that the concept of legal immigration actually was introduced to the United States, and it sort of shaped not only the trajectory of Chinese Americans, but of course then Chinese food in America for...
Yeah, and the legislation itself came about really as a result of what was going on in California at the time. So this is in the wake of the building of the railroad and the gold rush, and there was pretty widespread racism that really drove this unprecedented act that itself then drove the way in which Chinese food took hold in the States, because food became a way in for many people.
Well, Americans saw Chinatowns as places of vice, places where you get where you found opium dens and a lot of illegal gambling. But most of the immigrants came to San Francisco and then to a lesser degree to New York. How did we wind up with Chinese restaurants in almost every American town?
Well, one of the fascinating things, of course, is there are more Chinese restaurants in this country than McDonald's, Burger King, and Wendy's combined. And so in a way, it's more American than some of these other things that we think of as quintessentially sort of heartland. So one of the interesting things is when the Chinese first came to America, the Americans didn't like Chinese food, right? They thought these people ate rats. If not rats, they ate cats. If not cats, they ate dogs, right? So it was this like weird and gross food, and these people ate with sticks. It was very alien, very, very foreign. And what happened was the Chinese people often were competing with jobs with Americans. And so there was a lot of boycotting of people who hired Chinese people, you know. And as a result, you had this legislation and just sort of a lot of societal forces that drove the Chinese into two main fields instead of, you know, working on railroads or working in factories. And those were cooking, right, with restaurants, and cleaning, which are Chinese laundries. Right. And these two areas are both women's work and thus not threatening to American males. And so basically you have immigrants from China in San Francisco then fanning out across the country, not competing with each other, trying to do restaurants and laundries.
And the early, the Chinese-American cuisine that we associate with the old days, like chop suey, egg foo young, to some degree, weren't they variations on real Chinese dishes, but in the same way that Italian-American food used the local ingredients, tried the best they could to come up with something similar to back home, but wound up being very Americanized? Isn't that the same sort of thing happened here?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, chop suey was kind of like a proto General Tso's chicken. It was a dish that really catered to American tastes. It was pretty bland and
gluey.
Gluey, and you know, with as Jenny talks about in the film, it's very kind of recognizable meats, you know, like pork or chicken or beef. So it's pretty simple, and yet it seemed exotic. It had this funny name and had these, you know, curious vegetables.
Yeah, the vegetables that they have, which were like bean sprouts and snow peas and water chestnuts, are all very crispy, interesting textures, but they have no flavor, right? So you don't have like mustard greens or like bitter melon hanging out in any dish that you're serving to Americans at that time. So chop suey was this nice combination of the familiar and the foreign into this very, you know, kind of nice package that is delivered to Americans. And in a way, that formula is what General Tso's chicken mimics to this day.
Can we credit Richard Nixon with making Americans more conscious of authentic Chinese food?
It was certainly a
Authentic is a weird thing, isn't it? Because China has so many different cuisines. It's a huge country with many different regions.
Right. I mean, the authenticity question is a whole world unto itself. I mean, because food is constantly changing and adapting, or we're changing the food, really. But I think certainly Nixon's visit to China was a kind of watershed moment when a lot of Americans saw Nixon eating Chinese food and became newly curious. It was also around the time when these immigration rules were finally changing and finally opening up immigration to folks from different parts of China. So the spicier cuisines from Hunan and Sichuan province started to arrive.
Although, Jennifer, I've been told by any number of Chinese people that if you want food that's really like China, you have to go to Canada.
Oh, yeah. No.
Why are we still not doing it right? Well, there are some restaurants here, I assume, that come close.
Yeah, I would say that generally a good rule of thumb, if you want real good Chinese food, is to go where Chinese people are waiting online, especially in the cold. And there's actually a restaurant here that I just discovered where that happened in Midtown East, of all places. So part of the authenticity of Chinese food in terms of like high cuisine, so this is not just sort of the street food, is a function of immigration laws and visa laws. So Canada actually just has a lot more welcoming visa policy towards high-end, very professional Chinese chefs, whereas the kind of visa policies that would allow those kinds of creators to come into the United States is much more limited. So in fact, you have – so that's one. And two, what you had is a huge wave of Hong Kong immigration to Canada after the sort of, quote, integration. And as a result, you have a lot of Chinese people with money. So you have two things. You have people with money who want good food that are Chinese in their origin. And then two, you have the talent to create it. And as a result, Canada has those in much more sophisticated quantities than we have inside the States. So Vancouver, definitely one of the best Chinese restaurants in the world I've been to is in Vancouver.
Toronto's pretty good, too.
Yeah, Toronto's pretty good.
But we're getting better stuff here, partly because there are Chinese farmers now who are growing things that vegetables that were not available here in the past, things like water spinach and all sorts of things that you would have had to have imported, but wouldn't have been as good.
Right, definitely you can get a lot of this fresh just even the farms just around New York City, upstate and in Long Island now actually reflect the demand for fresh, you know, Chinese produce, you know, in Chinatown.
The film is called The Search for General Tso, and we've been speaking with Jennifer Lee, who produced it, and Ian Cheney, who directed it. It opens tonight at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village, and I'm very pleased that the both of you were on our show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.